Tuesday, and welcome to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And this week, we're going to focus on something that all of us are familiar with, but may not even understand what the foundation or actual problems involved with this issue are. Because we know the word, but we don't really understand how deeply it goes into our psyche. So if that's mysterious enough, the word or topic for today is loneliness. And the reason that I was interested in this topic, one is because it's so prevalent. And if you look at any trade journals or even the New York Times, you've seen articles over the last couple of years continually warning us about the prevalence of loneliness and how it's increased since the pandemic. But if we look even just a little further before the pandemic, we've been talking about loneliness and the issues surrounding loneliness since the 2000 release of Robert Putman's book, Bowling Alone, which first kind of signaled the modern issue of human beings needing to have community in order to maintain their mental wellness. But what's interesting to me is that although we've had loneliness as a topic on the side, we've continued to focus on the individual issues of anxiety or depression or mental health issues as being the foundation as to why we struggle. When if we just turned our head to the right, just a hair, and looked at loneliness, we would see that centered in the middle of this idea of loneliness, the definition of loneliness, that all of those feelings of anxiety and depression and isolation and even fears and maybe even OCD, maybe even ADHD are all living inside of the experience of loneliness. And I'm curious about this, not only as a professor, but also as a grandmother to a now third grader who seems to be thriving in all the areas of her life. But I understand how precarious things become at around third grade when all of the social groups start to really get tight and the interactions start to become much more nuanced. And all of a sudden there's queen bees and people that are starting to be left out of the group and the social circles. And we see the nuggets for loneliness starting there, which then can become depression or anxiety or fears around going to school. And so I wanted to talk about loneliness in the context of mental health with one of my new favorite people of all times, Lynn Lyons, who joined us earlier in the year, because this is her area of expertise. And I want us to get a real good handle on what loneliness looks like and how we can do that preventative work at home and maybe even translate that into our schools so that we can be better prepared to shift the conversation away from focusing on the individual as the source of their mental health issues and really look at the cultural context, which breeds these feelings of isolation or loneliness or depression or anxiety. So that's where we're going today. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you can be part of the conversation after our show by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can also leave me a message on our Facebook page or Instagram, and you can listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org or podcast our show if you like. Go wherever it is that you find your podcasts. Look for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Hit subscribe, and then the show will be ready for you to listen to at your convenience. So we'll take a quick break and come back and start our conversation with Lynn Lyons right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I just want to be okay, be okay, be okay. I just want to be okay today. I just want to be okay, be okay, be okay. I just want to be okay today. I just want You're listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest today is Lynn Lyons, psychotherapist, author, speaker, and co-host of the podcast Fluster Klux, Fix Anxiety. And after 30 years in practice, she has found her niche, maybe not after, but during the 30 years of practice, Lynn has found that she specializes in the treatment of anxiety disorders in adults and children. She travels the world sharing her understanding that treating anxiety requires a preventative approach at home and in schools. And in Lynn's latest book, The Anxiety Audit, she looks at seven sneaky ways that anxiety and worry weave their way into our families, our friendships, and work, and how to address them. Lynn's other books are Anxious Kids, Anxious Parents, Seven Ways to Stop the Worry Cycle and Raise Courageous and Independent Children, and The Companion, Playing with Anxiety, Casey's Guide for Kids and Teens. So Lynn, with 30 years of experience in your private practice, I'm expecting that you have a lot to say on the topic of loneliness.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be with you again, Elizabeth. I always have a lot to say, and I certainly have a lot to say on this topic. And I loved your introduction, the way that you framed this up, because one of the things, I mean, this is the way I'm describing myself recently. I may have said this the last time that I was on, but it holds now, is that I'm generally a happy, optimistic person who is irritated a lot of the time now, because the way that we're looking at these issues with our young people so forgets about, or at least minimizes, the issue of social connection. And at the very base of our beings, we are social creatures. And if you look at, you know, like I say this to schools all the time. If we want to make somebody crazy, if we want to give them the worst punishment, the worst torture, what do? We put them in solitary confinement.
Absolutely.
If we want to destroy children, sometimes for the rest of their lives, we put them in a crib in an orphanage and we leave them alone for months at a time, right? And oftentimes for these little children, there's no coming back from that, because our brains are designed, they're hardwired for connection, because our survival is dependent upon it. So when we've got survival stuff going on, and then we start thinking that modern technology and modern life is going to somehow override that, we're missing the big, big, big boat. So when I look at anxiety, when I look at depression, I so want people to recognize that these are social disorders in large part, and that loneliness and our inability or our difficulty or our world as it is right now, this lack of true connection, it's really something we need to start paying attention to. And I do hear people paying attention to it. So Peter Gray talks about play. He's been talking about play. Jonathan Haidt's new book, Anxious Generation, which I will admit that I was like, oh my God, do I have to read this book? Like, it's just going to make me more irritated. It's not going to tell me anything I don't already know. I was wrong. I loved it.
Oh, okay.
I did. It was, and the reason I loved it was because as I was reading it, I was agreeing with it. So of course you love things that you agree with, right? That just makes it easier. But the way that he frames up in a wonderful, very readable, compelling way, the changes that have happened in childhood, he blames it very much so on smartphones, and you can't argue with that in a lot of ways. But the changes, it really is so important for parents and for schools to start recognizing that when you start messing with something that's so basic to our human survival, to our happiness, to our flourishing, whatever you want to say, we're going to have problems are going to result.
Absolutely.
And thus problems have resulted. Yeah.
And I felt the same way about Jonathan's book, because I too mostly was singing to the choir, and the inside part ministry had this too. It's like, I've been teaching this in my class for 15 years. Why did he get to write the book?
I had the same thing. That's what I was like, oh yeah. It was sort of the same thing when Ellie Leibovitz started coming out with the space program of work with parents, not children. Everybody's like, oh my God, a revolutionary new way of treating anxious kids. I was like, no, but again, like, good for Ellie, because he put it in a way that's making it so accessible and so digestible, right? And so that's, I sing the praises of both of those people, because they are getting the word out in a way that's helpful. and necessary for sure.
I agree. I have therapist envy, but mm-hmm. I'm so happy because I think we've talked about this before, that the reason I started the show is I felt like I was the only person talking about these things. Mm-hmm. So now 15 years into it, I'm not the only person talking mm-hmm. about these things. And you and I were all finding each other, mm-hmm. so elevating that voice. So in that piece where the goal of the show was so that I didn't have to do the show anymore because we would take care of this issue, it's now coming to the surface. But there is a little part of me that's a little jealous that I didn't get there first. But
yeah, no, I get it. I get it. And I think what's interesting to me is how surprised so many people are, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's what sort of gets us going too, is that people are like, oh my gosh, have you heard that when you don't let kids play outside, it's bad for them? I'm like, really? You're just putting these pieces together? So yeah. Yeah.
You know, and the space piece, is that the title of the full title of the book in case people are interested?
No, it's called, I think it's called Breaking the Patterns of Anxiety and OCD.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that may not be the exact title, but it's something breaking the patterns of anxiety and OCD or something like that. But it's a helpful frame, and it's the frame that I've been using for a really long time, is that parents need the skills because these things run in families, because families are really powerful social and cultural units, if you haven't noticed. Yeah.
And that was one of the things that came up in the conversation I had with another one of your friends, Michelle Wiener Davis, mm-hmm. About divorce busting, that I said, I don't believe in therapy for children anymore at all. Mm-hmm. I would never mm-hmm. spend my children. I would never recommend it to my friends. I think that young people should go to counseling if they need a guide or a mentor, because they think they need answers and guidance. Mm-hmm. But therapy, right? That's a Jungian thing. We'll go there when you're 56. But mm-hmm. I feel that parents, as you said, need to have all of the information so that they can be empowered to do the work. So yes, you and I and Michelle and we're singing yeah. the song. I don't know how it gets accepted in the general public, because we've spent so much time, or the profession has spent so much time, you know, really digging into this, reduce the stigma. And it's got to be mm-hmm. a therapy for all the time.
Right.
That
right.
Turning the Titanic around that topic is going to be tough.
Yeah. Well, if I looked at my inbox right now, I know, because I looked at it yesterday, I have 4 emails from parents saying, I'm looking for a therapist for my 5-year-old. I'm looking for a therapist for my 9-year-old. I'm looking for a therapist. And I can't tell you how many parents I talk to when I give talks and lectures, et cetera, where they say, well, I've got my child in therapy. And I say, well, what are you working on? I'm sure I went on this rant the last time I was on the show. Mm-hmm. What are you working on in therapy? What are the goals? What are the homework assignments? How are you interrupting the patterns? And they're like, well, she's seeing a therapist and the therapist is really nice. I think they're doing play therapy. And I'm like, well, what are you learning in order to interrupt the patterns? Because if you are an anxious parent, if you are modeling these things, no blame, no shame, just a fact, we have to interrupt those patterns. And that's, I do think we're turning around the Titanic. I think, I mean, you want to talk about the stigma stuff that's going on right now, and how that's contributing to loneliness, and how that's contributing to passivity, which is a huge part of both anxiety and depression. That's something we really need to be paying attention to in terms of the messaging that we're giving our young people about connection, about what's wrong with them, about their brains, about their disabilities, about the problems that they're having. The very messaging that the psychiatric and the mental health field is giving these young people, the research, I mean, study after study after study is showing it's doing the opposite. And yet it keeps happening. Yeah. So
if you're just tuning in, my guest today is Lynn Lyons, psychotherapist, author, and speaker, co-host of the podcast Flusterclux, Fix Anxiety. And this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And so let's go there, Lynn. I want you to let's talk about the stigma piece and how the profession itself, because that is the whole point of the show, is the helping professions aiding or harming our collective mental health and well-being. And I think what you're talking about is evidence that our approach as a helping profession is actually harming our collective well-being.
So in a nutshell, yes. So here's the thing. When I look at anxiety and depression, and we're talking about loneliness, which is a state of disconnection, and loneliness, the thing about loneliness and what the research shows is that it is the perception more than the reality. So when you have a perception of disconnection, when you have a perception of not belonging, when you have a perception of being unlikable, that's what core deep loneliness is. I don't fit in. I don't belong. I don't know how to reach out to people. I don't know how to find my tribe. And so when we look at anxiety and depression, remember they're classified, they're categorized as internalizing disorders, which means you do it on the inside. So if we're looking at anxiety, we're looking at depression, we're looking at loneliness, we're looking at disconnection, and we recognize that the bulk of the work, the bulk of the harmful work is that we're doing it on the inside, then the more that we talk to young people about how this is who they are, this is their identity, they've got something wrong in their brains, it's not really something that can be fixed or addressed, they have a disability. The more we promote that language, what the research shows is the less likely that they are to take action that will make them feel better. So when people are anxious, when young people are depressed, when they're lonely, when they're disconnected, when they're isolated, a lack of action makes it worse, right? I mean, this is not, it's not, when you think about it, it's not hard to figure that out.
I know.
So why are we giving the message to these young people that actually supports a lack of action? Because what we know about loneliness and disconnection is that the more that you are engaged in things that are, per your experience, meaningful, out of your own perspective, right? We get you out of your framework, where you feel as if you are connecting to something outside of your own thinking, outside of your own emotions, the better you do. And very interesting study that was done a few years ago now out of the UK. So it was a meta-analysis looking at what helps teenagers with depression. And what they found, because they looked at everything, right? I'm sure they looked at all the different therapies, the ACT, the CBT, the DBT. They looked at all the different medications. What they found was volunteerism took the lead.
Yeah.
What is volunteerism? It means that you are offering something of yourself with no expectations that you are going to get paid or whatever. You're offering something of yourself that you determine is meaningful to other creatures. It could be animals, it could be the planet, it could be human beings, whatever. So when we look at loneliness and disconnection, and when we frame it as an internal state, and we offer the opposite, which is external connection, seems to me that that's kind of a no-brainer. And yet, much of what therapy does is make you more internally focused.
Yes. And that is the titanic issue for me, is that I don't know how we turn it, because we've spent the last 25 years, most of years in my practices, going down this path of making everything personal and internal, and you're sick and it's a brain disease and all the things that, and now what you're saying and what Jonathan Haidt is saying, what all of the clinicians I know now are saying is like, but wait, it's actually, let's just get people volunteering. But they need to find meaningful work. They need to feel challenged. They need to feel like they belong. I don't want to parent bash, but I feel like we're up against this wall of, yeah, but I'm too busy. Yeah, but I have work to do. I'm paying you to make my kid better. And there are enough clinicians out there. There's enough better help, right? Clinicians that are willing to take people's money and say, sure, I'll do therapy on your 9-year-old and we'll discuss their deep rooted feelings of the last 8 years. That's where I feel stuck and frustrated. Like you said, here's your annoyance. My annoyance is this: we recognize the issue, and yet it's like screaming into the void, because the easier thing to say is, I'll send my kid to therapy, we'll put him on a medication, and I can go to work, and I'm doing what the profession deems is the right steps. And so I am now absolved of having to feel guilt for my child's struggling.
Yeah. Well, okay. So fair enough. Okay. But I think there's something else that I've seen over the last few years that is probably more powerful than I'm too busy or I don't want to be blamed for it. I have not seen except in the last few years, the fear that parents have of their children having emotions.
Oh, okay.
The fear of their children being rejected, the fear of their children not fitting in, of being uncomfortable. I think, and what it comes down to is parents are afraid that their children are going to kill themselves.
Yeah. Okay.
And that, right? And I mean, and that is a huge driver.
Yes.
In, I'm going to do everything I can do. And there's this phrase that sort of has become kind of a mantra amongst these fearful parents: better safe than sorry, right? And so what they see as safe is, I'm going to do everything I possibly can because that is better than this incredibly unimaginable outcome. And I don't blame them for that fear.
No,
because yeah, because the drumbeat that they have heard about how horrible kids are doing and the things that they hear from all sorts of places, it is terrifying for them. So even in the most simplest of ways, right? So say I say, take your phone out of your kid's bedroom, or don't give your third grader a smartphone. Okay. They're like, but what if that means that they miss something? What if that means that they don't fit in? What if that means that they get rejected? You may have heard there's this thing now, a lot of these phrases or these, I don't know, whatever. You'll get it when I say it. Okay. There's this thing called rejection sensitivity dysphoria. Have you heard about that?
No, that's new for me.
Okay. Well, fasten your seatbelt because it's coming across the pond. Rejection sensitivity dysphoria. And what they're saying is that this is a thing. They've given it a label. They've given it a name. They say that kids with ADHD are much more likely to suffer from rejection sensitivity dysphoria. And basically what it is that when you get rejected or perceived that you are rejected, you have a very significant, big, painful, sometimes explosive reaction. Okay. Now, how does that help when we're talking about increasing connection, when we're talking about building social skills, when we're talking about the concrete process of teaching young people how to get out of their heads and seek connection? If we say, you know what, you have ADHD, you have anxiety, you have depression, and now you also have rejection sensitivity dysphoria, that if it were a pharmaceutical ad, we would say also known as RSD. And what we give is this language for parents to say, oh, what a relief. Now I know what's wrong with my kid. And then what? And then what do you do? I mean, the place where I look that I am impressed with compared to the anxiety depression field that I hang out with is what we have done with people on the spectrum in the last 30 years.
Right? You have good feelings about that?
Compared to what it was 30 years ago, for sure. Okay. Because when I started in my field, these kids were put in helmets literally, yeah, and put in rooms by themselves and that sent to special schools. So what people have done now, there's a whole group. I'm just talking about the people who really know what they're doing with this. They said, these young people, these kids, once we identify them correctly, by the way, not based on a quiz that you took on TikTok, when we identify them correctly, they have difficulty with social connection. That's one of the hallmarks of their disorder. We've got cognitive rigidity, other things going on, but this is where they end up isolated. So these people said, we're not going to do the disorder. We're not going to isolate them more. That's stupid. We're going to teach them social skills. We're going to address this head on. We're going to say, look, you have trouble with this. This is what you do. Here are the do's and don'ts. And if you watch like the show Love on the Spectrum, right? We've got lovely families. They pick the families that are lovely. Lovely families that say, this is what my kid struggles with. This is how we've taught them. This is how we've coached them. And people on the spectrum who are given the opportunity to learn skills, to talk about social stories, to figure out pragmatic language, have done so much better than they were doing 30 to 35 years ago. Now, I mean, we can have a debate that in the autism world, has it swung? Is there some parts that have swung way over the other way? Yes, absolutely. I was just talking to somebody who had a friend who says she has adult onset autism. Okay.
I also know a person with that same self-diagnosis.
Yeah. Adult onset autism. Maybe you had autism and you didn't know it, but it didn't just come on. So anyway, so there's a whole lot of kookiness over there too, for sure. But when we look at what really solid professionals people did, they focused on teaching the skills. Mm-hmm. Now look at what we're doing with anxiety and depression. Are we teaching skills? Are we talking about the brain as being malleable? Are we talking about neuroplasticity? Are we talking about the social components that both result in people ending up in this place and also help them get out of this place? We are not. As a field, we are not. Now, maybe, like you say, Elizabeth, behind closed doors, people are like, yeah, I know. But are we saying out loud over and over and over again, depression and anxiety need to be treated in the environment of social connection? We're not.
100%. No, we're not. Because there is, again, from the professional standpoint, there is that licensure fear, because if the standard of practice is diagnosis, medication, treatment, and we who know better say, well, that's a nice story, but really you need to make sure your child's on a sports team and you need to make sure that you help them learn to communicate and you need to let them feel frustrated. If we do that, we're on the hanging ourselves out there a little bit. And I think that that's one of the biggest issues in really taking a broader step forward, because there is that licensure issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think it's getting, like, in the last year, or even with the, you know, with the publication of Anxious Generation, mm-hmm. and with voices that are talking about the importance of play and that kind of stuff, do you think the needle is moving at all? Do you see that at all?
Just from my experience teaching at the university, I've just seen doubling down on DRC accommodation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For students mm-hmm. who need mm-hmm. to have their comfort pet in the classroom, mm-hmm. who need to take their exams in all the DRC accommodations have multiplied rapidly. So if that's mm-hmm. an indication of us taking steps in a different direction, absolutely not. And I find myself pushing back against them more and more with my students. One of the things in my class is I don't let them bring their computers or their phone to my class, and they have to take mm-hmm. notes the old-fashioned way in a book. And the last quarter or so, I've had students say, well, my accommodation says I have to have my computer to be
able yeah. Yeah.
And I've said, why don't you try it my way? And if it doesn't work, then feel
yeah.
And no one brought the computer. So no, Lynn, I don't, that's, I think, at the crux of this whole thing is that there is so much research supporting how we help kids go forward. And yet it's a small privileged group of families that are actually getting the benefit of this. Because what happens is if you have a lot of money and you want your child to get treatment, you're going to send them to a psychiatrist because you assume they're the best. Mm-hmm. And then you have the biggest chance of your child being medicated. If you have no money at all, you have to use whatever is the social services that you have. And it's going to include a psychiatrist. So you're going to get some sort of diagnosis. You don't access that middle ground that you and I work in, which is let's use common sense. And so that's my concern, is that the reach isn't big enough. But if you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And my guest today is Lynn Lyons, licensed clinical social worker in private practice for 30 years and an absolute expert in the treatment of anxiety disorders in adults and children. We're going to take a quick break, regroup, come back, and continue our conversation right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBS.
This is a warning for all you kids out there. Get off your devices, they've all become vices. Look what's happened to the world. Get off your devices, have pizza slices. All of you boys and girls, get off of that internet. Come out to the outer net. Run around and break a sweat. You'll have a good time, I bet. We got trees and bumblebees. We got bikes with banana seats. We'll build a jump on Lakehurst Street, and we'll bloody up both our knees. Get off your devices, they've all become vices. Look what's happened to the world. Get off your devices.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. My guest today is Lynn Lyons, psychotherapist, author, speaker, co-host of the podcast Flusterclux Fix Anxiety. All right, Lynn. So we got to spend the first part of the show putting the gripes out there.
Yeah.
How do we move forward? What gives you hope? Why did you write the anxiety audit? Because clearly you write a book when you think you've got an answer.
Yes. Because you don't write a book because you think it's going to be fun. Just anybody out there who's thinking they want to write a book, right? If you think this is going to be a fun thing, you're just going to want to play pickleball. Look, here's the thing.
Okay.
So you're working with college students.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There right now, so you have the age group that has been marinated in this.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we had to pick a group that is going to be the most invested in this accommodation model, the most invested in that there's something wrong with them, it's going to be college students. If you talk to my husband would say, like, look, just give up on the college and high school students, Lynn. Just don't even, just like the horse has left the barn. Like, just there's some truth to that. What I am seeing, mm-hmm. which is hopeful, is that younger parents are paying attention to the mistakes of the older generations. So they're looking at the high schoolers, they're looking at the colleges, they're looking at the nonsense that's going on, they're looking at the incredible difficulty that they're having with technology, with their kids at young ages, how third graders with smartphones is really a bad idea, the social struggles, and they're looking for answers. And I think the pendulum is swinging back a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And what gives me hope is that the number one topic that I'm being asked to talk about in schools this fall is helping parents understand why we put rules in about smartphones.
Okay.
Right? So the second topic that schools want me to talk about is educating parents and their faculty, because school people really need a lot of coaching with this, is why avoidance makes the problem worse. Because one of the things, so schools are paying attention to the fact that smartphones have taken over their classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
Teachers can't teach. They can't compete. And that the school avoidance since the pandemic has really become a problem. And the amount of resources that a school has to put in place in order to get a kid back into school or to educate a kid who won't show up for school has been incredibly taxing. So when I look at what's happening in schools right now, they're all kind of saying like, oh, yikes, a lot of bell-to-bell school phone practices.
Yes.
Yep. And a lot of interest in rethinking all of these accommodations. Now, it's going to take some work. And when you talk about turning around the Titanic, that's a good analogy, because it's not like we're on a jet ski and we're going to be like, woo, let's go the other way.
No.
So it takes a consistent and interesting and compelling delivery of this message that, like you said, makes common sense to people.
Yeah.
It makes common sense. So when we're talking about loneliness, if loneliness gets me, like, I don't know, as a therapist still, when somebody comes in and tells me they're lonely, that's the thing that breaks my heart, is when somebody says they're lonely.
Because they're desiring to have more connection. And
correct.
I know, it's the worst.
Correct. Loneliness is an unmet desire. Loneliness is a need for something and a want for something that you're not meeting. So when we're talking about loneliness, if we can frame it up for parents, that loneliness prevention means a few things. One, it means getting your kids and getting yourself into real life synchronous interactions.
Yes.
Which means taking away the phones.
Yes.
It means involving you and your family in activities that are based on doing stuff with other people. Even if you're doing stuff with your extended family, doing stuff in real time with other people. Isn't it sort of ironic that we're all like, oh my God, this pandemic, we're on Zoom all the time. I can't see my family. We can't go do this. And then the pandemic ended and we're like, okay, we like our phones now more than we liked them before. Right.
And my family's annoying, or my friends are annoying.
Right.
A pain to get in my car and drive someplace. All the excuses.
So when we're talking about the things that parents can do that are commonsensical and that you don't need a therapist for, right? These are the things that Peter Gray is talking about. This is what Jonathan Haidt is talking about. This is what Lenore Skenazy, Free Range Kids. This is what these people have been talking about for a good long time now, that kids learn connection through play. That kids, when they are given the opportunity to figure things out on their own, they're developing social skills. They actually are developing executive functioning. And it leads to them feeling as if they belong to something. And it's not about quantity, it's about quality. But the more that these adults keep stepping in and saying, we're going to structure your life in a way that we hope works for you when you're 32. We're not sure what it's going to do when you're 8, but when you're 32, you're going to thank us. When we have a profession that says, when kids have difficulty figuring things out, we're going to diagnose them. We're going to talk about what's wrong with them rather than teaching them the skills that they need. Now, look, I am not totally against diagnosis, because, and I probably said this before, when you have OCD, if you don't know what OCD is, you think you're losing your mind. And then somebody says, no, it's called OCD. That's why you have these intrusive thoughts. It's a weird thing that happens in your brain. That can be incredibly helpful. So True. The diagnosis itself is not a problem. It's what we do with the diagnosis that makes me crazy.
So if
we're thinking about loneliness, and we always want to make sure we're not, as I say, doing the disorder, that means we don't do what the disorder or what the problem calls for, then if we're struggling with an epidemic of loneliness, then why would we continue to give younger and younger kids devices that support being alone? It is very easy to be alone on a school bus when you have a phone in front of you.
Right?
When I travel, I like my phone, because when I'm sitting at a restaurant by myself, it keeps me company. I could very well have a book. In the old days, I used to have a book. But when we're looking at the social development of young people, and we're so afraid of depression, we're so afraid of anxiety, we're so afraid of suicide, we're so afraid of self-harm, we're so afraid of loneliness, why are we continuing to promote ideas and practices and products that do the very thing that we're most afraid of. It doesn't make any sense to me.
My guest today is Lynn Lyons. She is a psychotherapist and author. Her latest book is The Anxiety Audit, which looks at seven sneaky ways that anxiety and worry weave their way into our families, our friendships, and work. And we're going to talk about like some actual steps. And I want to throw this thing that always has bothered me, the comparison between depression, anxiety, mental health concerns, and diabetes, as if it's some sort of medical condition that you get. Mm-hmm. That they're not the same. But I'm going to say this. I'm watching the US Open, and Alexander Zverev from Germany mm-hmm. is a diabetic. Mm-hmm. And he has to test himself during his matches. And yet he is a professional tennis player on the tour. And so if we're going to put the two things together, and also the tennis world and the sports world really hyping up the whole anxiety and depression pieces, if they focused on the doing part of becoming a professional athlete, that's how we address and still live when you have a diabetes diagnosis. If you have an anxiety or whatever diagnosis, depression, the doing of the sport in different ways is the way we heal ourselves and moving forward. I think mm-hmm. one of the downsides of the big push of showing all of the athletes talking about their mental health concerns is that the message is almost then don't do anything because Correct. You're fragile. And so that is harming the whole case for no, when you have depression, anxiety, you go do the things and find ways to function. But I think the message is retreat, retreat, because it's scary and bad.
Correct. And I need to, this is the whole thing of mental health days that okay. drives me crazy. Right. So I like that. I'm a huge tennis fan. And so we've been watching the US Open as well. There's also a difference between, and not that I'm a diabetes expert, but there's yeah. a difference between type 1 and type 2. So if we want to compare anxiety and depression to diabetes, let's make sure we're comparing it to type 2 diabetes, because there are lifestyle things that can really change whether or not you both develop type 2 diabetes and then how you manage it, right? So type 1 diabetes, you're going to get it. There's not much we can do about it. So when I hear athletes, when I hear these tennis players, when they're talking about anxiety, when they're talking about that they need to step back, have you noticed that it's very often coincides with social media? So Naomi Osaka, right? So she was a relative unknown person. She is clearly temperamentally shy. Mm-hmm. So being in the limelight was going to be hard for her. She became famous within a week, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody knew her name in a week. And what she talked about was the demands on her from the public, the social media, everybody coming at her, being in front of everything. It wasn't that playing tennis wasn't fun. It was that the way that she was trying to connect to the world changed dramatically. I was just, Iga Swiatek, right? Number one player in the world is trying to figure out how to balance all of this. And so when I hear these tennis players talking about the stress of their profession, for one, I mean, I think it's really hard to be a professional tennis player, like the travel and the exhaustion and all that kind of stuff. Like, it's not all that it's cracked up to be. But I think when they look at the incredible pressure that they have, not as tennis players, but mm-hmm. as celebrities, as public figures out there in social media, creating content, doing all this stuff, I think that is really, really wearing them down. When we talk about mental health days, so I contribute to an article about this. And again, I was like the cranky one in the corner yelling like, maybe it's not such a good idea. that when states pass legislation that say children should be allowed to have a mental health day, hey, how about we just say, you know what? When you're exhausted, you can take a day off. Mm-hmm. Why do we have to call it a mental health day? Why can't we? When I was in high school, and I went to a very demanding high school, and there were times when I had too much work to do. I was exhausted. I was a good student. I wasn't trying to get out of anything. And I would say to my mom, can I just take a day off? And she would say, sure. Right. We didn't have to have legislation that said I was allowed to have a mental health day.
Or a diagnosis.
or a diagnosis to do it, or a written accommodation that gave me permission to take time off when I needed to. So I think the more that we pathologize normal human emotions, and the more that we create this environment that our brains and our bodies and our social desires aren't capable of managing, we create this environment and then we say, gosh, what's wrong? You must have a diagnosis, right? So I like metaphors and I like analogies. So here's one of the things, okay? So I have a cat named Pippa, okay? She is a delight, but she is a sassy little monster. And I took my son's cat in for the summer because he was traveling. And his cat is this sweet little dwarfish black cat who has never bitten anything in his entire life. Pippa was extra, as the young people say, and was so pushy with him. Like, he'd just be sitting there minding his own business and she wanted to play, and she would come flying in from the other room and attack him, and he was trying to defend himself. Well, what we discovered over the course of having him here for a few months is that poor little kitty was peeing where it shouldn't pee. It was peeing in the front closet. It was peeing in the basement. It was peeing in a box of my books. It was not his fault. We put him in an environment that he couldn't handle. Pippa was the equivalent of an overscheduled, phone-addicted teenager. And poor little Alfie responded with a stress response. There was nothing wrong with Alfie. Alfie didn't need a diagnosis. Alfie needed to go back to my son's house, where he is back to being his delightful pee-in-the-litter-box self. When we put creatures in an environment that is so unbelievably stressful, they are going to respond in ways that are normal for the stress that they're in. Mm-hmm. And when we are talking about the loneliness of these young people, they are in an environment right now with technology, with the way the world is set up, with the way parents are completely stressed out and structuring their kids' lives down to the minute. It is no surprise that we have the equivalent of a generation of kids that's peeing in the front closet, right? They cannot manage what we are throwing at them. It's too much. It's too much.
One, that was a wonderfully lofty analogy of the two. Can picture the the overscheduled teen. But also, when we're talking about the responses to fears or loneliness, or the parents' response, I'm trying to get my words around to it. Maybe we need to shift away from a suicide prevention model to a loneliness prevention model. Uh-huh. Suicide prevention just starts off scary, just starts, yep. Right? So, but if we talk about, hey, we're going to do loneliness prevention, and here's what these programs are, and we're going to add them to schools. We're going to have the friendship bench where, you know, you can, if you want a friend, you go sit on the bench and someone will come sit. Like, we put these things in. That's a much more positive, I would imagine, way to approach this, and also make our day-to-days less comfortable at home so that we go out and do things. Participate, volunteer, model that for our children. So
if you were going to teach your kid, get your kid to have their driver's license, right? Mm-hmm. Which I've gone through. I don't know if you've gone through, right? Mm-hmm. Would you sign your kid up for a class that was called head-on collision, fatal accident prevention? Or would you sign them up for driver's ed?
That's great.
Right. So when we talk about suicide prevention, I love that we have to talk about, instead of suicide prevention, let's talk about loneliness prevention. Let's talk about fostering connection rather than, and this is the nature of the United States of America and probably other countries too. We're very reactive.
Yes.
Right. This is the other reason why, Elizabeth, when people say, well, we should just treat mental illness like, physical illness. We should just treat mental health like physical health. I'm like, have you been in the United States of America? Right? We suck at that. Mm-hmm. Right? So friendship benches. Are you familiar with, we're all familiar with the ACE scores, right? Adverse childhood experiences. Are you familiar with the positive childhood experience research?
No.
So of course, somebody who you and I would probably like, said, hey, wait a second. We keep talking about adverse childhood experiences. What bolsters kids up? Like, what actually helps? And they did research and they found that kids, even if they had a high A score, which a lot of people do, if you had these certain things in your childhood, it buoyed you. It didn't just mitigate the A score, it like buoyed you up. And a lot of those things had to do with, not surprisingly, social connection, including two non-parental adults in your life as a kid who think you're the bee's knees. And when I go into schools, I say to the, I've been doing a lot of opening day keynotes. I say, there is no excuse for a child in this school not to have two of you here, right? Some kids can have them outside of school. Somebody who, when they see you, their face lights up and they go, oh my God, hey, you've got, you grew so much over the summer. Tell me about your blah, blah, blah. Connection, connection, connection.
Right.
When,
Well, we think it has to be the peer groups as well. As I started the show, third grade is a tough time for the peer relationships start to all divide up. Now the parents start to get crazy because they don't want their child not to be the most popular. But I can tell you, both of my girls found great joy in picking up trash with Louis the janitor in elementary school. They loved Louis. And today, and they'd come back, Louis had said, I missed you yesterday. So you're so spot on with that, Lynn. And for teachers to be encouraged, because we've told teachers this fear model of, oh my gosh, kids might look for the warning signs of all these things. If we were able to say to teachers, greet your students by name, know something about them, and that's the best mental health care that we could have, right? Across the board. You're so spot on. It's the simple things.
Yeah. It's, I hear stories about like kids that are afraid to get on the bus, right? I specialize in anxiety disorders. But there's a bus driver who's driven the route for a few years, who knows all the kids, who sings silly songs, who greets them all by name. And once this little kindergartner realizes that the person greeting him in the morning is this really friendly human being who looks him in the eye and says, hey, how you doing? How was the weekend? Get on the bus. It makes a difference. And I think that the, as I said, and I say this a gazillion times, probably a day, the more we pathologize, the more we look for what's wrong, right? I mean, we have something in this field called, you have a somatization disorder, right? That means that any little thing that you experience, you turn into an emergency. You think that a headache is a brain tumor. You think that a tremor is a stroke, et cetera, et cetera. Our field has done a very good job of doing that to parents, that they are so afraid. And if we can just recognize that sometimes the simplest things that we can do, the most commonsensical things that we can do, is for a child, a teenager, an adult, to feel connected in real life with other people, why is that not on the top of the list, right? Think of postpartum depression. Think of what we've done with that. Think of how much society has changed in terms of a new parent bringing home a baby and not having all of the other women in her community saying it is totally normal on day six to feel like you've made a horrible mistake and to cry your eyes out. Right? Being able to pass on this history, this long history, and this incredibly ingrained history of connection, and looking and seeing what we've done right now to disrupt that. I just think that more schools, more therapists, more people in the public need to talk about that instead of talking about, to go back to the tennis players, I was having a mental health issue, so I had to leave, saying I was having difficulty, I was feeling lonely and disconnected, and this is what I did so I could stay.
Yeah.
Right? It's a different way of framing it up.
And sometimes that's all it takes, is looking at the issue from a different perspective. And I love what you said. You know, we look at things from a trauma lens now instead of from a positive what's working lens, because I want to end with this idea, the reminder that there is that resilient child phenomenon, kids who can grow up the worst situations you could actually imagine and they thrive. And we're not quite sure why, but these resilient children are a great model in seeing that if we give kids the opportunity to connect and feel value and useful, everything else tends to take care of itself. everything else takes care of itself. We also have to be able to accept that a lot of things are going to suck. And that's right. When we say, and I think you said the perfect thing, there's going to be trauma, there's going to be disappointments, but if we focus on the things that are going well, they're going to outweigh the others and give us a place to start.
Yeah. And figure out the skills. If things keep sucking,
yes,
where's the skill deficit? What do you need help with? Because you keep finding your place. You keep finding yourself in this place. Mm-hmm. How can we look where the gap is in what you know how to do, what you need help with, what you need coaching with?
My guest today has been Lynn Lyons, psychotherapist, author, speaker. You can hear her podcast, Fluster Clucks, Fix Anxiety, but also find Lynn's latest book, The Anxiety Audit, which looks at the 7 sneaky ways that anxiety and worry weave their way into our families, friendships, work. You're going to find those tools that you need to help your family to thrive. But if people want to get in touch with you, Lynn, how do they find you?
So my website is lynnlyons.com. And there's also a website for the podcast, flusterclucks.com. I've got Facebook groups. I'm not hiding. So you can find me. I'm out there. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. If you have any questions about what you heard today, you can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com or follow us on Instagram or Facebook. Leave me a message. I'll be happy to respond. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. You can also podcast our show to share with your friends. But as always, thank you for tuning in. Thank you for supporting public radio. And thank you for listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
1, 2, ready, go. Tree, yeah, that's where I'd like to be when the world falls down. No one can say nothing, which I guess means they'll say something, but I won't.